Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are along for the ride today. The special committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol last year delayed the hearing it had originally scheduled for yesterday due to the Hurricane Ian, that began slamming parts of Florida yesterday. Damages and flooding are making Ian one of the most severe storms in history. Today on Midday, let's check in to see what the committee is expected to cover in what could be its final public hearing, as well as what else is going on in Congress as the midterm elections draw ever closer. Election Day is November 8th. My guest is Theo Meyer. He's a national political reporter for The Washington Post and a co-author of the Early 202 newsletter, and he joins us on our digital line from Washington. Hey, Theo, how you doing?
I'm good. Glad to be with you, Tom.
Always glad to have you. So let's talk about what the January 6th committee is likely to talk about when they do reconvene. They were delayed because of the storm in Florida. We don't know, as far as I know, we don't know when they're going to reconvene. Is there any new information about that? Any indication?
Yeah, it's unclear, when exactly they will reconvene to hold this final hearing ahead of the midterms. The House is planning to leave town and probably will not return until after the midterm elections as members head home to their districts to start campaigning. But that doesn't mean the January 6th committee cannot hold another hearing during that time. They've held at least one previous hearing while Congress was not actually in session.
And we understand
the final hearing is expected to focus, at least in part, on how some of President Trump's associates were planning to declare victory, whether he won the 2020 election or not, according to some of my colleagues.
And evidently, Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Thomas, is speaking perhaps at this hour with the committee. She appeared live this morning. I mean, she's going to talk to them in person rather than by video conference. Any indication what the committee wants to know from Mrs. Thomas?
Yes, Ginny Thomas is in fact meeting with the committee probably as of now. She appeared in person on Capitol Hill this morning. The committee has been seeking to interview her for months, to learn more about her role in trying to overturn the election. It came out when the committee got former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows text messages that she had been in touch with him. This is significant, of course, because she is a conservative activist, but also the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
And do we expect that the next hearing, whenever that takes place, will have a kind of star witness or two? We've had a few hearings of the seven or eight that have taken place so far, people like Cassidy Hutchinson and others, who've really stood out as witnesses with pretty blockbuster testimony. Any notion that there's going to be a star or two in the next time?
Well, it's not a star witness, but the committee is considering showing video footage of Roger Stone that was recorded by Danish filmmakers who were filming him for a documentary, in the weeks before January 6th. So it's possible that video footage will be played during the hearing.
And meanwhile, in the House and the Senate, this movement to pass the Electoral Count Act looks like it's on track to happen. Mitch McConnell has evidently come out and given it its blessing. Remind us what the Electoral Count Act will do should it pass both houses.
So the Electoral Count Act is a 19th century law that governs exactly what happens, the sort of process that Congress goes through to certify a presidential election. It became controversial after the 2020 election when President Trump and his allies tried to exploit ambiguities in the law to hold up the electoral count and try to delay or prevent Biden from becoming president. This was part of the, whole scheme to have Mike Pence, block the certification of the election. So Democrats afterwards and, a few Republicans concerned about this, Democrats tried to push through these changes to the law, including a whole package of voting rights reforms, this big package that they tried to change the filibuster to pass and failed to in January. So this is a much more limited effort only to sort of tweak the Electoral Count Act and was viewed as really the only thing that they could get Republicans on board with so that they could pass it despite the filibuster still being in place.
So there are a couple of differences between the Senate version and the House version. Any sense of where it'll finally end up and what those differences are? Do they seem significant to you?
No, I think the biggest difference is really how Republicans in the House and the Senate have approached this bill. House Republicans rejected the Electoral Count Act. House Republican leadership was whipping against it last week. There were only 9 House Republicans who ended up voting for it, and all of them are either retiring or lost their primaries. But the effort appears to be much more popular, much less divisive in the Senate. Senator McConnell came out in favor of it this week. And in a committee vote on Tuesday, there was only one Republican, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who voted against it. So this, appears to be on track to pass the Senate, although it's not likely to come up for a vote until after the midterms.
And what is Senator Cruz's and the others who oppose it? I know Senator Hawley from Missouri is another person in opposition to the bill. What's their argument against updating this, as you said, 19th century law?
Well, one argument is that that Republicans weren't really doing anything new when they objected on January 6th to the certification of the election. And Cruz has pointed toward previous Democratic objections to the elections of Richard Nixon, George W. Bush, both in 2001 and 2005. And Donald Trump in 2017, when he won for the first time. I think it's really a stretch to say that Democrats, in these positions were, really doing anything similar to what Republicans did on January 6th. These were isolated objections by, one or two or three members, not in the case of Republicans, nearly 150 people mounting a real attempt to block the certification of the election.
So, for example, as you've reported in the Post, in the current law, just one House member and one senator can raise an objection to any particular state's results. This is what was happening at the time that the insurrection began on January 6th of last year. This Senate bill would make that threshold now like a fifth of each chamber, both the House and the Senate. The House version makes it even more complicated, requiring a third of each body, the upper and lower chamber, to approve a debate about any results from any particular state. So that was one of the issues, I think, the ease with which people could block the process the last time. And of course, never in history had that process also been accompanied by a riot following it. So it does look like it's going to pass. Is this, in your view, something that, you know, both Democrats and Republicans are going to run on? Is it, you know, in these last several weeks before the midterm election, is this going to be an issue like abortion and the, you know, the dissolution of Roe v. Wade, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think the extent to which, you know, members of both parties will run on it is pretty limited. Most voters do not know what the Electoral Count Act is. Democrats could certainly, you know, run on saying that they had passed measures to try to prevent Republicans from blocking the certification of future presidential elections. I would be very surprised if any Republicans ended up running on this.
Theo Meyer is a national correspondent for The Washington Post. He's also a co-author of the Early 202 newsletter. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We're talking about goings-on on Capitol Hill. 410-662-8780 if you have a question or comment for Theo Meyer. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And you can always find us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. So, Theo, this Electoral Count Act has, as you've written on the last day or two, become a kind of yet another loyalty test to Donald Trump. Has Mr. Trump himself weighed in on this issue? And, you know, are the lines being drawn within the Republican Party for those who are pro-Trump, those who are less so? And are the is support for this bill, you know, breaking down along those lines?
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, in the Senate, it's a little bit more complicated. Cruz, you know, is the only member who has, you know, really wholeheartedly come out against it. Josh Hawley, you know, told CNN that he was leaning toward voting against it. It's unclear where, you know, some of the other lawmakers who some of the other Republican senators who objected on January 6th stand. So it is possible it will end up, you know, passing the Senate overwhelmingly. You know, one dividing line with these things is sometimes, you know, which Republicans are eyeing future presidential campaigns, you know, and want to remain on the good side of Trump's voters for that reason, and which are not. So, you know, Senator Cruz is widely viewed as a, you know, potential Republican presidential candidate in the future, as is Josh Hawley. It's unclear where some other, you know, potential future presidential candidates, such as Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, are going to come down on this bill.
How about Liz Cheney, who, of course, lost her primary in Wyoming, will not be returning to the House next year? She's still on the committee investigating January 6th. Do we have any indication? She was, if I recall, one of the original sponsors of the House bill. Where is she standing on this these days?
Yeah, she was one of the original sponsors of the House bill. She, you know, this bill has already, you know, cleared the House, so it is possible that it will come back to the House, you know, if the Senate passes, you know, a different version. But I'm not sure if there's any reason to think that it will do any differently than it did when it, you know, previously passed the House. Although it's possible if it comes up, you know, after the midterm elections that, you know, maybe Republicans who have just won re-election will be a little bit more comfortable voting for it than they would have been right before the midterms.
How about Democrats? Anybody in the Democratic caucus opposed to this? And if so, how come?
No, I think the Electoral Count Act has, you know, pretty unanimous support among Democrats. There's certainly Democrats who would prefer that they would have gone much further. You know, I think Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader of New York, said back in January that, you know, just reforming the Electoral Count Act would not be enough. But Schumer has, you know, ultimately gotten on board with this as, you know, really the only thing that could possibly pass a Senate in which Democrats, you know, only have 50 votes.
Theo Meyer is my guest. He's a national political reporter for The Washington Post and co-author of the Early 202 newsletter, which is essential reading about politics in Washington. We'll have more with Theo Meyer after a quick break. To join us, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. You can follow me in the Twittersphere at @TomHallWIPR. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Hi, I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Hala Vince.
In the coming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll be sharing five advantages of health savings accounts and also some key findings from a new report on the rapidly evolving workplace. You can find the Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life podcast on WYPR's website and mobile app, wherever you get your podcasts, and at transamericainstitute.org.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Books. We're going to talk about two books having to do with racial inequities here in America. They're two novels. The first is by Dr. Wendy Shia. Her novel is called The Black Cell. It's a dystopian fantasy about black liberation and armed resistance to white supremacy. And as well, I'll speak with Naima Koster. Her novel is called What's Mine and Yours. It's this year's Maryland One Book selection. They're both really interesting books, and we will have conversations with Wendy Shia and Naomi Koster, or Naima Koster, tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Theo Meyer. He's a national correspondent for The Washington Post, and we're talking about national politics. If you'd like to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and you can tweet us @MiddayWIPR. So Theo, this time of year, around the 30th of September, which is tomorrow, that's the end of the fiscal year for the United States government, and we always go through a little bit of a dance in Congress about what's known as continuing resolutions to keep the government operating. Where does that stand? It looked like, a week or two ago, there was the possibility that the government would shut down. Any possibility? How does that possibility stand at this juncture, a day before the deadline?
In theory, that possibility, still exists up until the moment when lawmakers send a bill to the president's desk. In practice, I think there's essentially no chance of a shutdown here. Neither party wants that right before the midterms. And the biggest issue that threatened to trigger a potential shutdown was a standoff over something Democrats were trying to attach to this bill, which is a permitting bill that Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia, has championed. Manchin got Senator Schumer to agree to try to pass this bill before the midterms in exchange for his vote for a climate package, a climate deficit and healthcare bill called the Inflation Reduction Act that Manchin agreed to support over the summer. But part of the deal was that Manchin had to round up enough Republican votes to pass this bill in the Senate. And even though Republicans have been calling for permitting reform for years, Manchin was unable to gather enough Republicans in the Senate to advance this.
So in terms of the agreement that Schumer and Manchin had, Schumer has lived up to his part of the bargain. He said, "We'll allow this to happen, but you, Joe Manchin, have to go out and find the votes," right? So we're not in a situation where Schumer has somehow, reneged on any part of the agreement that he entered into.
Yeah, that's correct. Schumer does not have the ability to deliver Republican senators. That was on Manchin. There are a few Democratic defections, Democratic senators such as Tim Kaine, who have said that they opposed this bill. But I think the bulk of Democratic senators were on board with it for two reasons. One of them, the deal that was cut with Manchin and, you know, sort of following through on that. And secondly, this bill would have eased permitting not only for, some fossil fuel energy projects, but also for interstate transmission lines that need to be built for renewable energy projects. So some groups were supportive of this that support renewable energy projects as well.
It also includes $12 billion for Ukraine. It's in effect for the next, 2.5 months, right? So this covers October, November, and half of December. Using your crystal ball, Theo, what do you think? What is going to happen in the middle of December when the CR runs out yet again? I mean, Congress has a long tradition of kicking the can down the road a little bit. This gets them through the midterm elections. But at that juncture, I guess as your colleague Paul Kaine has reported in the Post, we've got all these appropriation bills that could be passed. That's one way of running the government, which is the way it's supposed to be run. Or we can keep doing these continuing resolutions. But what do you think is going to happen in December?
Yes, you're right. This sets up another spending fight in December. It is possible that Manchin will have another shot at trying to attach his permitting bill, perhaps with some tweaks to the legislation in December. That's what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business groups that favor it are pushing for. It's possible there will be a larger spending fight ahead of Christmas in December. It sort of remains to be seen what the battle lines will be there. Part of it depends on what happens in the midterms. If Republicans do very well, retake the House, retake the Senate, they will have a lot more leverage, come January, and this will be the last gasp of a Democratic-controlled Congress. Whereas if Democrats defy expectations and manage to hold on to the Senate and even perhaps the House, although that is a tougher road, party control won't be changing and the stakes will perhaps be a little lower.
And how do members feel about the chances of one or the other party taking control or, keeping control of the Senate in particular? You've got in Pennsylvania this race between Mehmet Oz, the TV doctor, and John Fetterman, in which Fetterman seems to be ahead. You've got Herschel Walker in Georgia running against Raphael Warnock. I think the latest poll I saw was Walker was actually up a couple of points in that, but it's close. Out in Arizona, you've got Blake Masters, who's a real Trumpy candidate, as are Mehmet Oz and Herschel Walker, running against former astronaut and current Senator Mark Kelly. There's a lot of pundits weighing in, thinking that it's perhaps unlikely that the Democrats will be able to keep either house. But what are the folks on the Hill telling you in your reporting about this? How are they? What are they expecting, if they're expecting anything at this juncture?
Well, Democrats' odds are certainly much better in the Senate than in the House. The chamber is currently split 50-50. Democrats feel good about Pennsylvania, where Republican Senator Pat Toomey is retiring. Their candidate, John Fetterman, despite having suffered a stroke right before the primary, has been leading Mehmet Oz, the Republican candidate. So Pennsylvania is a real bright spot for Democrats. And if they won Pennsylvania and, every other race remained in the control of the party that holds it now, they would actually increase their majority in the Senate. But it's, of course, unclear, whether the parties that hold the current seats will be able to, retain control of them in the midterms. And some of the races that are closest are in Wisconsin, where Republican Senator Ron Johnson is running in a very tight race for re-election Wisconsin is a sort of perennial 50-50 sort of state. And two Democratic senators are facing especially tough races, Raphael Warnock in Georgia and Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada.
And, you know, it remains to be seen, obviously, how this is going to come down. But it's interesting, the politics of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Mr. Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, Ms. Sinema, the senator from Arizona, who's not up in this cycle, but Kyrsten Sinema at an event in Kentucky with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican. And again, Senator Sinema is a Democrat, but had high praise for Senator McConnell, much to the chagrin of some of her Democratic colleagues. I mean, she continues to be an enigma and a conundrum, as does, in many instances, Senator Manchin. What do you make of that situation between Sinema and McConnell? What's in it for Senator Sinema to be so lavish with her praise of the minority leader 6 weeks before the midterm elections?
Yeah, she's certainly not the first Democrat to appear at the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville. But it was striking that she appeared there 6 weeks before the election, and that she was, you know, pretty lavish, as you mentioned, in her praise of Senator McConnell. He was also, even more lavish, I think, in his praise of her. He called her the most effective first-term senator that he'd seen since joining the senator. He praised her as a genuine moderate and a deal maker. This is the sort of thing that sort of drives Democrats crazy. She has a bit of a different style than, Senator Manchin, as you alluded to. She's much more of an enigma. Manchin is a talker and, talks and talks and talks in the Senate hallways. It's much clearer, where he stands on things. And he also represents a state that went by Trump, for Trump, by enormous margins in 2020. It's sort of miraculous that he managed to win there, whereas, Senator Sinema represents a purple state now, a state that had been in the Republican column for a long time, but that is, much closer to 50-50 now. So it's much less clear that she needs to take the stances that she has taken, for political reasons than that Manchin needs to do that.
Now, and as you mentioned, the House is a different story than the Senate. Kevin McCarthy, who's itching to be the next Speaker of the House, appears to be pretty confident that Republicans will, in fact, take control of the House. But as you've written in the early 202 in the Washington Post, there's some dissension among the ranks of Republicans. where do you think how would you gauge the level of unity and consensus in the Republican Party? They did come out with this memo called the Commitment to America. Is there anything in there policy-wise that is noteworthy, and does it represent a sort of unified message among Republicans? We hear a lot about the pro-Trump Republicans and the anti-Trump Republicans. Where do things stand?
Yes, this Commitment to America is an allusion to the Contract for America, Contract with America, that Newt Gingrich and Republicans ran on way back in 1994. It's a pretty vague document. Part of the intention is to try to keep Republicans together if they, actually do, retake the House. Speaker, who would be Speaker McCarthy, would be able to, go to Republicans and say, look, this is what we ran on. This is what we're doing. There's, of course, a much bigger battleground in the House, dozens of close races across the country, and, the aggregate outcome of those will determine control of the House. There's just a lot more opportunities for Republicans. Redistricting alone, has given them a bit of an advantage, and it's possible they could win the House back simply on the strength of you know, the changes that have been made in redistricting in Tennessee, for example, where Republicans were able to carve up the Nashville seat that was safely Democratic. It has been split into three different districts and is now essentially impossible for a Democrat to win. That's one Republican pickup right there. They only need a handful of them.
And, you know, we hear a lot of talk about if there is a Republican majority and Kevin McCarthy does become the next speaker in the next Congress in January, that will be treated to things like, well, first of all, the January 6th committee will be dissolved. But there's even talk of investigating the January 6th committee or impeaching President Joe Biden. These things that we hear from the, you know, the extreme right of the Republican Party. Do you think that those kinds of moves are likely if there's a Republican majority come January?
Well, there's a limited amount that if the Senate remains in Democratic hands and the House is Republican, there's a limited amount that House Republicans will be able to do on their own. But one of those things is hold investigations with subpoena power, you know, into Afghanistan, you know, what happened there with the Biden administration's pullout last year, you know, perhaps into Hunter Biden, President Biden's son, you know, into all aspects of the Biden administration. So, yes, I think it is extremely likely that Republicans will wield their investigatory powers to the fullest. It is also possible, of course, that they could impeach President Biden, although, you know, I don't think there's any way absent, you know, President Biden committing some sort of incredibly serious high crimes and misdemeanors that the Senate would ever have the votes to convict him. The Senate, of course, did not have the votes to convict President Trump, you know, despite him being impeached twice and, you know, trying to overthrow the 2020 election on January 6th.
And as we finish up here in our last minute or so, with things like the passage of the CHIPS Act or the Inflation Reduction Act, Mr. Biden's fortune seemed to have improved immeasurably over the last few weeks. People are now talking about the very real possibility that he will actually very, very strongly consider running again for re-election despite his age, for example, is one of the reasons people have thought he wouldn't do that, to say nothing of his political fortunes. But his fortunes do appear to have improved. Would you read it that way as well?
They have improved a little. His approval rating has ticked up a few points, although it's still low by historical standards. 538, which tracks, you know, aggregate approval rating, saw it tick up from about 38%, which is very bad, to around 42% or so, which is still bad.
Yeah.
So, but it's not apparent in every poll. There have been some very recent polls, such as a Selzer poll out in the past few days that found his approval rating at 36%. A Washington Post poll from a few days ago found it at 39%. So it's unclear to some extent, you know, how much it has improved and how much it will continue to improve or plateau or, you know, decline again.
Yeah, and we will, of course, keep an eye on it. But, you know, when you're talking about somewhere between 36 and 42%, it's a difference of bad and less bad. It's not by any means a difference between bad and good. Theo Meyer is a national political reporter for The Washington Post and co-author of the early 202 newsletter. Thanks, Theo. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, a new take on a classic play. J. Wynn Russick has a review of Our Town at Baltimore Center Stage. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.